Perfect, Sarah.
Start the recording now.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sarah. Perfect. Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to the meeting this afternoon. Hopefully everybody can hear me clearly. As we remain in unprecedented times, can I ask for everyone's full cooperation and to adhere to the new guidelines with regards to the conduct of the meeting? Could I also maybe ask members if we can all mute our mics if possible? There's a bit of feedback. Yeah, perfect. Lovely. Okay, so everyone should ensure their mobile phones are turned off or switched to silent and the use of mobile devices for recording is not permitted. Members of the public should not speak during the meeting and may be temporarily excluded for discussion of in-committee items. Members of the press and public must refrain from using the instant message facility during the meeting, and anyone found to be doing so will be given a warning. Failing to adhere to the guidelines for a second time will result in being removed from the meeting. I would remind members of their obligations under the Councillor's Code of Conduct to declare any financial or significant non-financial interests which they have in any item of business before the committee today. If they have such an interest, please either declare it now or immediately before the item itself, stating the item of business it relates to. Having declared an interest, members should leave the meeting by hanging up from the call for the duration of the discussion on that item and should not take part in the vote. You will then be invited back to join the meeting once the discussion on that item has ended. The proceedings of the meeting will be audio and video recorded, except where Council is considering any exempt matters. The recording equipment is linked to the microphone system on the computer, so please ensure your microphone is switched on before speaking. Members are reminded they are personally responsible for any comments that they make at the meeting. Please ensure, if you wish to speak on an item, use the instant message facility to indicate you wish to speak and I'll bring members in as listed. Members should ensure their cameras are switched on when speaking and cameras should also be switched on when a vote is being taken. And I'd also want to remind members to keep their instant message to the following letters. Type Q to ask a question, P to propose or S if you want to second. And please refrain from making any other comments using instant messaging. If two councillors propose at the same time, the person who proposes first will be taken as the proposer and the person who proposed second will be recorded as the seconder. Now, firstly, Sarah, can you maybe advise me if we've any apologies for the meeting this afternoon?
Yeah, we have apologies from Councillors Dorn, Pyle and McAvoy.
Thank you, Sarah. Any other apologies from the floor?
Councillor Valerie Hart.
Thank you, Charlie.
Marie Ward, Chief Executive Chair.
Thank you, Michael. Okay.
Sorry,
so, yeah.
Laura, David Taylor, I'm not sure whether David's on yet or not, but he said he'd apologize a bit late, but he will be there.
No bother, Robert. Thank you very much. Okay, so as we know, this is a special meeting of Council at which we have representatives from the South Eastern Trust, the Northern Ambulance Service, as well as the Southern Trust. And I want to thank the representatives of all three for your attendance today. We all fully appreciate the pressures that you and everyone within your organisations remain under and the very difficult year that it's been and the further challenges that the future holds. So a thank you to you all from this Council. I'm aware that all three organisations have a meeting today together at 5:15 p.m. this evening. So I need to be even stricter in terms of our time management this afternoon. So the plan will be that each organisation will have 30 minutes in total, which will include their presentation, sort of our overview, as well then as questions from members and their answers. Sarah's hopefully going to keep me right in terms of our timings. So I suppose, given that, folks, can I ask members to keep the questions brief? And we will do our best to get through as many as we can. And any we don't get to, I'll ask members then to link in with Democratic Services to follow up in writing with each organisation. So I suppose before I hand over to the South Eastern Trust, do we have any declarations of interest from members or from the floor? Okay, perfect. I'll maybe pass on over then to the South Eastern Trust. I know that we have Seamus, Roisin, David and Claire on the call. So maybe a wee overview first of all from yourselves,
yeah,
and then we can open the floor to some questions, Seamus, if possible.
Thank you, Laura. Good afternoon, everyone, and delighted to be here with you again this afternoon. I think we last met in October, actually. And so much has happened since then. Obviously, we have some more information that we'll share with you today in respect of our consultant-led urgent care centre to Down and how that is going for the local population and how it compares with the services we had pre-COVID-19 as well. On the back of that, it'll be David and Andrew will probably pick up on those things mostly. We've also had a hugely challenging winter, which we're still in, and a massively challenging third surge through January and into February. And that surge, in terms of numbers of hospital admissions right across the region, was certainly 3 or 4 times what we would have experienced in the very first surge. And I know our colleagues in the Southern Trust were particularly hard hit through that time with their numbers almost double what we would have even experienced in the South Eastern Trust. I'm sure our colleagues will share that with you. But massive increase in numbers of hospital admissions. We had to double our critical care capacity. And on top of that, we were also providing staff to support the Nightingale critical care unit in Belfast. All staff right across all of our services, quite exhausted with the third surge. And I think there's been good general recognition of the incredible work that they've done and the need for our staff to get a bit of a break just ahead of us rebuilding our services as we're starting to sort of ramp up from April through to June in the next quarter. We'll not be fully back where we were pre-COVID at that stage, but we fully intend to maximise the rebuilding of services where that's possible. So much has gone on. At the same time as the third surge, we were starting our vaccination programme just before Christmas, with all of our care homes in the South Eastern area having their first dose before Christmas and completing that in January. And that was absolutely critical at protecting our most vulnerable in society. And then starting with the staff vaccination programme just after Christmas and then working in tandem with our colleagues in the other vaccination centres and our GP colleagues vaccinating the entire population of Northern Ireland. Are those who want it will certainly be offered from an adult perspective. And it's fantastic to see the progress that's been made with the 700,000 vaccines having been administered. We expect to hit the 100,000 mark this week in the South Eastern Trust, which is fantastic. We've also been asked to take on the lead responsibility for establishing and setting up the vaccination centre at the SSE arena, where we will commence increased vaccinating from the 29th of March, hoping to do about 11,000 in that first week, getting up to almost 20,000 in the second week. And ultimately, when we merge our vaccination centre at the Ulster with the SSE, we are hoping to be doing about 40,000 vaccines a week. And that should help accelerate the vaccination programme for Northern Ireland and get anybody who wants a vaccine from the adult population should be able to have their second dose by August. And if we can make it any sooner, we certainly will. But it provides fantastic protection to our population. In terms of rebuilding services, just a couple of general comments. I think there's been a clear view that we need somewhere between 70 and 80% of our population vaccinated before we can really truly start to think that we're getting back towards normality, whatever that normality might look like. So the vaccination program is having a massive impact. But one of the things we don't know is what will new variants do in terms of our ability to continue this positive path forward. We're seeing a third surge in Europe. Their vaccination program is so far behind ours. But we're also seeing new variants. The South African variant is particularly concerning, as is the Brazilian variant. I'm hearing about the Californian variant now, which potentially the vaccination or the vaccine can actually work well against most variants, but is less efficacious with some of the more virulent variants. So there's a lot out there that we still don't know about. Another patient died in our hospitals today, and we still have admissions every day. We still have people come to our emergency departments. We still have people in our critical care unit. They're not the numbers of surge three, but we still have a bit to go before we can really get back to where we all want to be. So our rebuilding programme will be a gradual one, increasing all of our services across the Trust. We will take the learning from this past year and make some of our services better, I have no doubt, than they were previously. And effectively, our roadmap for recommencing services or further building our services at Down Hospital will very much depend on some of those things. And it will be community transmission. It will be the vaccination rollout continuing. It will be understanding how the new variants will have an impact on our services. But thus far, we're already making really good progress in respect of outpatients at the Down, diagnostics, day cases. We have further opened up our emergency services, as you'll hear shortly from David and Andrew. And I think we've made good progress. We're still short of where all of us would like to be. But I must say, I'm very proud of our staff for getting us through this past year. They've done a remarkable job, and they will continue to be professional, committed, flexible, and excellent in everything they do. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. So that's just a few high-level comments I want to make. I'm going to ask David and Andrew to talk about some of the specifics around rebuilding services at the Down. Obviously, there's a number of questions that have been asked, and we've responded as best we can through our written correspondence. But we know that it's better to talk it out, hear some of those details, and then give you an opportunity to ask questions. So I don't want to speak for too much, and I'll hand over to David and Andrew.
Thank you, Seamus. Okay, David and Andrew, you can work away there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Laura, and thank you, Seamus. Andrew, I can't quite see you on Microsoft Teams, but I think Roisin was explaining at the beginning of the meeting that it's a little unusual for us to be in Microsoft Teams. Maybe you're coming. I think you're there.
I'm definitely here.
You're definitely there. Oh, that's good. That's good. Me too. Okay, thank you. I can see some people, but not everyone. So maybe just to start off with, my name's David Robinson, and I'm the Director of Hospital Services here in the South Eastern Trust. And what Andrew and I would like to do is maybe to talk a little particularly around, we thought to start at the front door. Seamus has mentioned outpatients and diagnostics and our inpatient wards and our day cases, but let's start at the front door and at the ED. And Andrew, he'll introduce himself, but is one of our consultants and CD for emergency care and works regularly in Downpatrick and has done for many years. So we thought we'd start there because I think from, not just from memory, but from the Q&As that came through, there were a lot of questions and queries just about that in particular. So if I take you back a little to before this third surge and what we would probably refer to as the worst of the worst surge, we hope. It was on the 19th of October that we opened the urgent care centre, and what we'd explained at the time was that that was consultant-led, and it was open and was open, remains open, Monday to Friday, 8 to 6, and is co-located there with GP out of hours, and maybe some of you have used that service in the intervening period or members of your family. It is home first, as it's said on the big signs in and around Downpatrick and elsewhere. And patients then telephone beforehand, as well as NIAS or colleagues in the ambulance service, telephone beforehand for an appointment to attend or are redirected from there to another service. And I guess the point of that is, and what we're trying to deliver there is to have the right patient in the right place first time. And we're trying to reduce the number of patients who come and are there and then may require what we refer to as a secondary transfer. So they're there, can't get everything they need, and they need to go elsewhere. And I might just hand over then to Andrew at this stage just to explain how that's going. And the reason for that and why I'm going back before we go forward is that that sets the context for where we're going to next. So, Andrew, can you explain maybe just some of the data that we've collected about patients who've used the service, maybe some of their experiences as well?
Yes, thanks, David. So, folks, I'm Andrew Jobin. I'm an NE consultant and the interim associate clinical director for emergency medicine across the sites, and I've worked in the Down now for over 10 years. Very briefly, again, just to touch on, there was reasons for the closing of the Down relating to the concerns about crowding, the number of spaces we had, the staff availability, the locum dependency, the queue they expected in the pandemic, the need for respiratory and critical care in particular that is not available on that site, the number of transfers that are currently were currently being performed and the delays in them, and the expected increase in transfers that would be required if our doors were just open. There's a number of other things around it, but those are the main things that concerned us, and that led to us closing the doors the 31st of March. We then went back with a minor injury service, and then added to that, after consult with yourselves, in late July, we opened the 19th of October. And really the ask upon the emergency department here was, what could we go back that was going to be resilient to the pandemic, knowing that we were in the middle of wave two in October and knowing that there was likely to be more significant waves going forward. And what we came up with this urgent care model that really let us manage the workload, make sure that we got into that site was the appropriate patient, make that was the appropriate patient for that site, and make sure that we got those that needed to be signposted to a more appropriate site, done at the earliest opportunity. And that's what David was talking about, the right patient to the right place the first time. So a small example of that would be somebody with stroke-like symptoms in Killyleagh, travelling to the Down, then requiring an ambulance that may be 2.5-3 hours down the track, taken to the Ulster, which is the definitive care for that that presentation. There's a number of presentations that really medicine's jumped forward massively in the last 10 to 15 years, and the outcomes are very, very linked to time and arrival at an appropriate site, and that's the same for heart attacks, neurosurgery, severe sepsis, surgical complaints, appendicitis, testicular torsions, etc. And none of those things were ever definitively managed on the Down site. And this was an opportunity with the phone first that we could divert some of that work directly to the more appropriate place. And the numbers and the statistics is quite useful to look at. If you walked into the Down, roughly about 3 patients a day were transferred to the Ulster for surgery, paediatrics and all the other services I discussed. And at the moment, we're diverting about 2.7 a day with the telephone first, and about 0.25 a day that walk that get appointments. So it's roughly the same number of patients. They're still being asked to transfer the care to a more appropriate site. We also have liaised very heavily with the GPs at the very start of the service, and continue to do so through our contacts in No More Silos, to try and make sure that we use their service as best we can. Downpatrick ED was very much a primary care heavy unit, with reduced admission rates below 10% compared to 25% on the Ulster site. So some of that work with talking with them, we're able to let them take back some of the work that they expected to be doing and we're keen to continue to do, like back pain, going to the first contact physio in the GP practices, as well as the sore throats and things like that, which historically used the ED perhaps more as convenience than necessity. So our numbers have reduced in what we're seeing. We're probably seeing about 55% of what we saw when we were open in 2019. But that's got to be taken in the context of a pandemic that's seen all departments shrink by about 30% in terms of their attendances. Across level 1 EDs, it is 30% of December statistics. Across level 3, the minor injuries type units, is 40%. So the contraction isn't significant, given that we've given some of the work away to the primary care service and diverted some directly to the most appropriate place. Our service is set up with consultants in most days initially, and we recruited somebody else very early on, put the advert out at the end of October, and appointed somebody in December that added to that team. So now pretty much 99% of the time there's a consultant there, along with a senior specialty doctor or associate specialist. We're getting about 1,000 calls a month. We're seeing about 75 to 80% of the patients with appointments same day. There's 72% of them are being seen within 15 minutes of arrival, 92% within 30 minutes of arrival, 75% are leaving within an hour, having their whole problems dealt with and discharged from. We've significantly reduced the number of transfers required by ambulance by around 80%. So that means those patients who were coming by ambulance from the Down area to the Down, they then waited to be seen, blood assessed, referred to another specialty, ambulance booked, second ambulance comes to pick them up and takes them to the definitive care, and has been reduced significantly, which is a significant burden I'm sure my NIAS colleagues will agree with. And we're able to provide a significant suite of services. We're still doing over 500 x-rays a month, 30 CT scans, 130 take-home medicines, 4 or 5 MRI scans being organised via the Ulster site without having to interact with the services up here, and about 40 ultrasound scans. So the service is probably doing a high percentage of what was always done, and able to reduce some of the workload and some of the risk in terms of getting the right patient to the right place at the right time. The service, very quickly, for those who aren't aware of it, is very simple. It's a direct line to the urgent care centre. It's a recorded line. You give some details and you get put through to speak to usually one of our consultants, if it's felt to be a medical problem, or one of the nurse practitioners if it's a minor injury. An appointment is given. And as I say, 75% of the patients are seen, and seen within 2 hours.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm just very conscious of our time here to get some members who have some questions in. So thank you for that, and David and Seamus too. I see we've got Councillor Casey, Lewis and Councillor Brown. I'll maybe take your questions all at the one time and then bring the trust back in afterwards. Charlie, you were first there. Go on ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much, Laura. I appreciate that. And I'd like to welcome all of from both trusts and from MAES. My concern is, Ryan, I know you must be congratulated on that, the fact of where you're rolling out the vaccinations. I mean, and that's the information I'm looking for is available, from, I'm sure, from both trusts anyway. I have received the first jab. It's the second jab. They say you need it as a sort of a banker to mitigate against the excesses of any of the new strains. And my question is around new strains. Seamus has just mentioned now the Californian strain. I mean, obviously this is a smart virus. How can people mitigate? And normally, if you listen to what people are telling you, normally in any sort of virus of this nature, it takes about 4 or 5 years to develop a real good vaccination against it. But and this has been completed in less than a year. How are you mitigating against the way this virus is able to chop and change? It's an absolute nightmare. It's a nightmare for us, and it's almost like for medical experts like yourselves. How do you mitigate against that? And how effective then will both the first and second jab that people like myself are getting, or for any citizen across the north, against these new strains?
Thank you, Charlie. If it's okay with the trust, maybe take in Councillor Lewis and Councillor Brown as well, and we can come back to that. Alan, do you want to go on ahead there?
Yes. That's fine. Thank you, Laura. No, look, just firstly, I would like to thank the representatives from the trust of all of the hard work that you have been doing. And I know that it's not easy keeping things afloat and keeping staff numbers at the appropriate levels. It was just, again, to comment on the issue of the down A and E. Although I accept your reasoning for removing the A&E, I don't really agree with it. I'm glad that the trust had entered into talks with local councillors to put the urgent care centre in place to try and solve some of the issues which we were sort of feeding back to you. So look, I thank you for actually doing that, but I'm very, very conscious that I'm not wanting the Down Hospital just to be sort of sidelined as, yes, that we can't do this, we can't do that, that we've never had the sort of capability to do that. So it's just to bring you back on to, is there a date and a time frame and a scale that we're actually going to see the A&E returned to the Down, and would you be prepared to put on the record today that the A&E will return to Down, just to reassure those people who have done fantastic work in raising the issue of Down and campaigning, just to make sure that those vital services are there?
Thank you, Alan. I'll bring in Councillor Brown next, then go back to the Trust to hopefully try and address those concerns. Patrick Brown, Councillor Brown, do you want to go ahead there?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'll start off by saying I fully concur with Councillor Lewis's statements there and thank him for raising them, and would also like the same clarity with regard to the A&E services. What I specifically wanted to ask about was last week I was brought some very concerning rumours, reports that there is a plan to reduce the mental health services at Finnison House in Downpatrick and reduce it from a 7-day-a-week service to a 5-day-a-week service, taking away the provision at the weekends. Seamus, I have emailed yourself on that, but I just wanted to raise it in this forum to ask if those are indeed rumours, or if there is any basis to them, and if the Trust is planning any sort of changes or reductions to mental health services in the Downpatrick area, and if not, can they make that categorically clear on this call, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Okay, can I hand back the Trust then? We had a query regarding the new variants, one regarding Down A&E, and I think also regarding services at Finnison House.
Well, I'm going to start with the last one first. And yes, I'm more than happy to set the record very straight and clear here. There are absolutely no plans at all to remove the weekend mental health service from Finiston House and relocate it to Belfast. And I don't know where these rumours come from. And I have to say, I am somewhat irked that, for example, Councillor Brown chose to actually put out this statement on social media, either Thursday or Friday, saying that you'd received disturbing reports that we were going to transfer the service. That is absolutely not true. And I would prefer, if any of you have issues or concerns, that you would ask the Trust about them first. I know Councillor Lewis emailed me, and I emailed and responded, that there was absolutely no truth at all. So what happens is, you hear rumours, you put them out, and then you assume that they are a fact, and you start making statements on the back of that fact. We have an obligation to communicate responsibly with the public. We have an obligation not to create anxiety with the very people who need to access our mental health services. So just to be putting this very clearly on the record, it is absolutely not true. We have no plans. That service will be there. If the service gets more demand, we will put more resource against it. That will be how we deliver the service. So I don't know where the rumours come from, and I would make a plea. Please talk to us before you start putting stuff out in social media. That's how we get a constructive relationship. That's how we get a constructive engagement. So I really would make that plea. Because another councillor from Near Morning Down then, Catherine Owen, she put out a post on the back of that, assuming it must be true as well. So when councillors start to put these messages out as if they are factual, it does not do the people we serve any good. In fact, it creates anxiety where there's no need. So that's the first thing I would say. In respect of the other two issues, the vaccine second jab, Councillor Casey, it's a bit of the world of the unknown for all of us. Now, scientists are saying there's no evidence that our vaccines cannot cope with new variants. It's the extent of their ability to cope will be the issue. Now, what we're hearing is there's very strong evidence that the vaccine is 70% plus and 80% plus, depending on the vaccine, effective in stopping people getting the disease, and basically 100% effective in stopping people getting it seriously, requiring hospitalisation or critical care. So thus far, the evidence is very strong, but I suppose it's still a big unknown quantity. And if you think about the variants that are sort of kicking around Europe, there is a bit of a concern they will wash up on our shores in these isles, and obviously our vaccination programme should help against that, but it's still the unknown. But I think there's still good confidence. In respect of Down ED, the simple thing for me is I've always been very clear that we want to return to the services we provided pre-COVID. Now, we're not doing too badly, not doing as well as you would want us to. I understand that, but we have to be sure that our services are safe and that they're sustainable and that we don't create any cross-infection for people who come into our hospitals. So we don't have an ability to open the doors at this time. And as Andrew has actually said, whether we want to open the doors the way they were is up for debate, because actually what we're currently providing is a model of care where patients are not inappropriately attending the hospital and going straight to the place that they need their care. We've got a model of care which is ensuring that people don't attend inappropriately for what could be given in primary care. We've got a model of care which is very quickly meeting the needs of those patients who should be coming to the hospital. Now, there's a group of patients that we're not currently dealing with through the consultant urgent care centre, and that's those generally older patients who have a chronic respiratory condition. And under a pandemic such as this, where this virus attacks the respiratory system particularly, you can understand why we're not going to go there at this moment in time. but we can absolutely aspire to get back to the point where we're admitting those patients in through the front door. Call it an ED, call it a consultant-led emergency care centre. We can have that debate going forward. The thing for me is, can we provide the same services that we were providing? That's what we still want to do, and we're edging towards that.
Okay, Seamus, thank you for that. I'm conscious we've only got about 5 minutes left with yourselves. We've got three more questions there from Councillor Trainor, Sharvin and Andrews. John, if you can keep your questions as brief as possible, and hopefully the Trust will have time to answer it, and if not, we can get back in writing. So, John, do you want to go on ahead there?
Thanks, Laura, and I suppose I haven't read the response, and I'll be just asking questions based on the response that was received via letter, but again, it shows that there's no actual real commitment being made for capital expenditure at the downside. And I refer back to figures from back as far as 1718, which we had been talking about in these health working group meetings, where there was £35 million spent 1 year on the Ulster, £49 million the second year, £22 million the third year. In Lygon Valley, there was £579,000 spent first year, £2.4 million, and then £1 million. And then you come to the down, £481,000 spent, £811,000 spent, and £484,000 spent. It just seems that the down is seen as the third priority all the time. And the reason, and I hear what James is saying, especially around where members may push certain information as if it were fact, even if it maybe were rumour, but whenever you have the position where you are not being seen as being given a fair allocation of capital investment, where you're not seeing the expansion of the physical infrastructure on site that can provide the capacity needed for further service expansion, then you can see why such rumour can make it to the fore. You can see why such rumour can take hold. And as a point, I hate to do this because I really genuinely want to be able to work with you in a constructive way. But you can see from the perception from within the community why we are always hesitant. You know, that's maybe one point. The second point is around, you know, we can beat about the bush as to what happened to the ED and why it was closed and why Lygon Valley was retained. We all know it was down to the number of beds and the distance then between Belfast and being able to move patients. We all know that the number of beds that were reduced in the Down, had they not been reduced, could have put them on an even keel with Lygon Valley, which would have made the decision a bit more difficult for yourselves as to which unit you would have utilised for your dual pathway approach. So look, that's in the past. I'm looking at the future at the minute now, and I need the commitment from yourselves that where there is the opportunity for capital investment into the Down to expand the physical infrastructure and then expand the services that can be provided, I would be asking for that commitment here today. That is the commitment I need, that the hospital will be expanded to ensure that it remains an integral part of the network, because I know that it is a current integral part of our health network, but it needs to remain that way. And at the minute, we're centralising so many services in Dundonald where we are creating a bottleneck. We are creating a bottleneck, and I'm sure that you're very much aware that there is a bottleneck in Dundonald. So the more services that can be delivered in the likes of the Down or the Lygon Valley, remove them from the Dundonald, can free up space at Dundonald for other services. And also with regards to the diversion of patients, we talk about how patients receive an appropriate care at the right place. Well, patients are transferred to Dundonald on a regular basis. Well, maybe it's a case of those less acute cases, the minor injuries that are being seen at Dundonald, maybe they should be transferred to Downpatrick to free up the space for those people who are suffering from traumatic incidences. That's all I have to say, Chair.
Thank you. John, Councillor Sharvin.
Yeah, I'll be quick, Chair, because we've 1 minute now. Yeah, first of all, I think it's really good to hear from Andrew Dobbin on the ground of how he is experiencing the emergency department in the Down and what he is seeing. And those figures, you know, they're really positive. I'll not take away from the Trust on that. They seem very positive. But as the Trust know, we want our emergency department back to where it was and even furthermore 24/7. I know that's a big ask of the Trust, and I'll continue to ask it because that's what people are asking of me. But the questions that I had was from Seamus's response there to Councillor Lewis's question around the emergency department and the time frame. To me, it reads that the plan that you submitted to the Minister last on Friday just passed, you're clearly stating that there's no plans to increase the services at the emergency department before June 2021, because that is the time frame that you have stated in the letter response. So It's understand, can you confirm that there's no plans for the emergency department or any additional services to be added to the DAO between now and June 2021? It's good to hear you confirm the Finsen House. It was raised concerns. People did contact me. I didn't post it up. So it is good to hear that you confirm that. But I really want to emphasize the emergency part, which you did state yourself is what's missing at the DAO. You know, the distance from Killock or Strangford, for example, to the Ulster could be the critical difference between life and death. You know, that ambulance that gets to the patient then having to divert, as you say, past the Down to the Ulster could really be the difference of a person living. And that is why people continue to ask for an emergency department that's fully equipped to accommodate people. So that's my main question, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Sharon. I'm conscious that we are out of time. Terry, if you're content, can you maybe email your question into Sarah in Democratic Services and we can get it answered that way? And maybe just very briefly to the Trust, would you be able to sort of give a snapshot of answers to Gareth and John's questions? Would that be possible?
I'll get Bryson to talk about the capital, but what I want to say to you is you've forgotten that you got a brand new hospital in 2009. Rushing will tell you all of the details around the millions. The people of Lisburn would bite your hand off to get the level of investment that the Down Hospital has had in the past 12 years. But I'll let Roisin say some of the details around that. In terms of the Councillor Trainor's views around new services, capital, not getting more, I just want to remind everyone that some of the things we've changed that would be considered a loss would be the 24/7 ED, and we no longer have inpatient cardiology. Now, what did we add in the past 12 years? Well, an urgent care cooperative with our GP colleagues on site, with their out-of-hour service, as well as now two GP practices on the site. We've secured the Down as a regional centre for cataract surgery, only one of three, and for ophthalmology outpatient services. We chose to put our Trust-wide bowel cancer screening service in the Down Hospital, not in the Ulster, not in Lagan Valley. And we chose to put our Trust-wide sexual health services in the Down Hospital, not in the Ulster, not in Lagan Valley, and certainly not Bangor or Ards. We put our midwife-led unit in place. We have our frail elderly rapid assessment service in place. We've increased the volume significantly of our outpatients, our diagnostics, and our day cases on the Down Hospital site. We have now got Marie Curie based in the Down Hospital as well. And we have integrated teams for diabetes, respiratory, a whole host of services where they're working between the Down and community services, including enhanced care at home. We have expanded the physical capacity by creating more inpatient services, and basically there's no room at the inn. So, yes, we would love to do more, but I think something is getting lost in translation here for whatever reason. There has been far more brought to the Down Hospital than has been taken away. And that hospital is being maximised to its fullest. If we can do more, we would love to. But I just want to say to people, there's a draft budget going on out there. You maybe want to talk to your political parties about what it looks like and how that can be influenced at an assembly level. But basically, only £52 million additional recurrent funding for health and social care next year. That will just about cover the pay rise for our staff. It won't cover any inflation. It won't cover any demographic pressures or growth. It won't cover the cost of new technologies or drugs. It won't cover the cost of additional capital building and the revenues that go with that. And it certainly won't cover any costs of new service developments. So we all have a challenge in trying to bring more to the Down Hospital. But let's not forget how much has been brought to the hospital for several years. Roisin?
I don't think there's very much more to add on that. Seamus has answered it, but what I would ask, and everybody will know this, is, you know, I think we really genuinely want to work together with all of us. We need to get on the one page, and it's not about, you know, what's one hospital over another hospital genuinely. You know, we are really proud of the services in the Down Hospital. The Down Hospital is full. The services are appropriate. I'm more than happy to have other types of engagement forums, and I think that's something we could take up offline. You know, John, what I would say to you is The Down Hospital, actually, you know, we're pleased with the capital investment, as in we've got a new hospital. The Ulster Hospital, I'm in charge of capital, and we've been trying to get a replacement hospital there for over 20 years, and it's been very, very difficult. We haven't been able to get it as a new build. We got £64 million and delivered that hospital in 2009. And honestly, I really would ask us to flip this over to say, we've got what we need in the Down. It's fantastic. I'm proud of it. I'm still proud of it. The accommodation and facilities are still as good today as they were, and we have continued to invest in it. And if there's anything that you have heard, there's nobody looking for more capital that hasn't been realised. There's no requests, there's no list, there's nothing that the teams don't need that we aren't putting in there in terms of, you know, improvement of the theatres, equipment, everything that's been asked for, capital, we are prioritising it, and we're asking and we're trying our best to put it in there. We don't need a new building. We've got the new building there. The other two hospitals are literally falling apart. And if you know, if your family member was in a ward in the Lagan Valley, they would not have anywhere near the experience that they have in Down wards 1 and 2. There's 89 inpatient beds, and the feedback from everybody is good. I'm passionate about it, and I want to flip this over. The only other thing we would like, if not we would like, but for our local community, it would be good to have an MRI down there. We've asked the commissioner. We've completed developed a draft business case, and you know, support for things like that would be good. But you know, in terms of capital, we don't need to extend it. It's big enough. We've got a great estate there, and the Down Hospital is only part of it. There's Finiston House as part of that now. We're just about to invest £500,000 in supporting mental health and other community services capital into Finiston House. You know, 10 years ago, to be quite honest with you, I was told to dispose of it. But now our services have grown so much, we can't dispose of it. We've got plenty of services in the Downshire as well. It's almost like a health campus. I'm asking for you to really, you know, flip that one over and to work with us in relation to it. Thank you.
Okay, Roisin. All right, I'm just conscious.
I'm really conscious I didn't answer one of the, I think it was John's questions, or sorry, Councillor Sharman's questions about a time frame. Unfortunately, we don't have a time frame. I think you're right, your assessment of the period, April to June, we're very clear we couldn't open those doors again in the way that we did before, or we couldn't even as yet return the respiratory inpatient services through the consultant-led urgent care model. 70-80% of the population will need to be vaccinated. We're hoping to do that by August of this year with the second vaccine, but we will continue to see how we can build our staff up. For example, we will be putting an advertisement out for more middle grades. We will specifically try to target more middle grade doctors for the Down Hospital. We will be introducing a lateral flow test into our consultant-led urgent care centre. And when the time is right, that should allow us to then be able to increase the types of patients coming our way. And we work with our colleagues in the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service to particularly ensure that those who could be brought to the Down Hospital will be brought. So we haven't stopped working on this, but we know we have a few months to go before we can consider getting back to the pre-COVID services. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Seamus, thank you. And listen, thanks very much to yourself and the team for your attendance here this evening. I'm conscious that even with my own strict rules, I've ran over about 7 minutes, so we're in the back foot before we even go on to the ambulance service. Listen, thank you very much for your time.
You.
I know there was one question there from Terry Andrews and potentially another one there from Councillor Enright, but they can be followed up through Democratic Services. We appreciate the time constraints, so thanks again. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye. Take care. If we can maybe move on now to the next section of the agenda, which is the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. I think we have Michael, Rosie and Maxine on the call. You are very, very welcome, and thank you for being here. I know you've circulated a presentation to ourselves, which is on minute pad or decision time for members. Michael, am I handing over to you? And I'm not sure if you were here at the very start. The plan would be a half hour for ideally some type of a presentation, then some questions from members, and hopefully we can get a good few questions in during that time period. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for the invitation to join us or to join with you. We do have a short presentation, just a few slides, really, to set in place some of the context and challenges of providing ambulance service in your council area, which hopefully will be helpful for discussions. I am joined, as you said, by Rosie Byrne, Director of Operations. I'm not, unfortunately, joined by Maxine Patterson, shown on the first slide there. Maxine's been unable to join us this afternoon, but hopefully between Rosie and myself, we'll be able to answer all of your questions. Go to the next slide, please. Thank you. Seamus set the context that we're all working in and have been for the last 6-9 months or so. So in the interest of time, I certainly won't repeat that. I last met with council at the end of August 2020. That was in relation to the difficult staffing position that we were experiencing in our southern and southeastern divisions across the summer period, led to considerable media coverage, particularly around Newry Ambulance Station, as it was at the time. The challenges then were mainly linked to those around managing the coronavirus pandemic, and we were faced with anywhere between 20 and 25% of our staff unavailable for work at any time for COVID-related reasons. They were self-isolating or their family members were. We had the particular issue during the summer that we needed staff to be able to get a break, to get a rest after the very difficult first surge, and that led to those difficulties that we experienced last summer that led to us meeting at the end of August. Similar to as Seamus has outlined, after some respite during the summer period, the surge returned. So October really through to February, we've experienced an exceptionally challenging period, and that returned again to a high proportion of our staff off at any time, heavily reliant on our other staff who were available to work, agreeing to do overtime to provide the required level of cover in the area and right across all of our areas across Northern Ireland. More recently, I'm pleased to be able to say that the position has improved. We've seen a reduction in the number of our staff off at any time due to COVID, and that's partly the impact of the vaccination programme and also due to the recent reduction in community transmission. So that's welcome, and we're seeing an improved level of cover in all areas, including in the Newry, Mourne and Down council areas. Is, however, still very dependent on our staff being willing to work overtime, and therefore that's not sustainable. And I think we will see challenges again as we get into the summer, as some of the restrictions ease, where staff are keener to get time off work to be able to do things and less keen to work overtime. We split NIAS into 5 divisional areas, co-terminus with the 5 health and social care trusts, and obviously Newry, Mourne and Down Council, therefore straddle southern and southeastern trust areas, as you can see there on the map. Across Northern Ireland, just to give you a sense of scale of how many ambulances we have or we seek to put out, across Northern Ireland, we have at any time during the day, we would have about 60 double crewed A&E ambulances and about 50 at night, and in addition, we would have up to about 18 RRV, that's the single paramedic in a car, right across Northern Ireland. So not that many when you look at it right across the whole of the region. In our southern division, in which we have stations at Kilkeel and Newry in your council area, we aim at any time to have one crew working out of Kilkeel and 2 crews working out of Newry. That's both weekdays, weekends, days and nights. One crew at Kilkeel, 2 at Newry. If you move to the next slide, we can see the position for Southeastern Division, which has the other part of the Newry and Mourne Council. We're out of Downpatrick. We aim to provide 2 A&E crews day and night, 7 days a week, and 1 crew out of Newcastle 24/7. Plus, as I say, there will be some RRV support across that area. We also have our non-emergency patient care service and doing the non-emergency work, hospital transfers and so on. And over the last number of months, we have redirected some of those staff to support our A&E tier. If we move on to the next slide, please. And actually, if we just, in the interest of time, skip over, that's a bit of background. If we skip over that to the next one, which is about another valuable resource. No, sorry, back one. Back one, just if you can. It's another valuable resource that we have to supplement our capacity, which we're going back one too far. Never mind. If you can go to the next one that has the same heading on, please. That's it. Just leave it there. Another valuable resource just to supplement our capacity, our community first responder schemes. Now, unfortunately, it was necessary at the start of the pandemic back last March, this time last year, to suspend all of those community first responder schemes, as we couldn't guarantee we could safely dispatch them to calls because of the availability of PPE, etc. 16 of the 18 community first responder schemes are now live again. They are now operational, and there were plans to have a discussion in your council area to establish a community first responder scheme there. There's plans were to have that discussion in March, but hasn't been possible due to the COVID regulations, but hopefully we will be able to have those fairly soon, and we'd certainly be keen to have those discussions with you and others. If we could turn then to the next slide, with a few slides here, which just to give you a sense of what our response times have been like in your council area relative to the rest of Northern Ireland. So the first one here is about the demand that we've had since April last year until the end of January. We're receiving about 14,000 calls each month. That's the green line at the top. And you can see the red line at the bottom. That's around about 1,000 per day coming from the Newry, Mourne, Down council areas. Fairly steady over that period, but you can see some rise over the last couple of months in the number of calls we receive. Can you move to the next slide then, please? And this is our response time to Category 1 calls. That's those most serious, immediately life-threatening calls on the left, and Category 2 are potentially serious incident on the right. Now, Category 1 calls, following the change that we made in November 2019, now only account for about 6 or 7% of all of the calls that we receive. So they really are those most critical calls. You can see on the green line, we're not achieving the performance standard, which is 8 minutes. That's the red dotted line. You can see in the green line, we're average between about 10 and 11 minutes across Northern Ireland to respond to those Category 1 calls. The Southern Division is slightly higher there. That's the blue line. But the Newry, Mourne and Down Council area, which is the pinky coloured line, is higher again, rising fairly steadily there during the year, and between about 17 and 18 minutes to respond to Category 1 calls, which is significantly more than the response standard, and an issue that I know is of concern to you. The position for Category 2 calls is very similar. That's the chart on the right, where again you can see the Newry, Mourne and Down line is higher than both the regional line and the Southern Division line. If you move to the next slide, which has similar charts for Category 3 and Category 4 calls. So those are the less urgent calls, although people waiting for an ambulance has been categorised as 3 are still people who have got an urgent problem, as you can see there. The variation in the Newry and Mourne council area compared to the regional position is less marked on both of those Category 3 and Category 4 calls. They are within standard. It says there on that chart, it's a bit misleading. It says no standard. There is no there's no mean performance standard, but there is a 120-minute standard for 90% of calls, and we are doing that, as you can see, in about an hour and a half for Category 3 calls. It's a 180-minute or 3-hour standard for Category 4 calls. And again, we are within that at about an hour and a half for calls coming from Newry and Mourne, Newry, Mourne and Down that have been categorised as 4, and that's broadly consistent with the rest of the region. If you move to the next slide, what those charts don't show, those are all averages. What they don't show are some outliers. So there are undoubtedly people who wait much longer. You will hear about them, you write to me about them, and there's no doubt some people wait an unacceptably long time for an ambulance. So we do need to continue to work to improve our response time on a consistent basis, removing that variation, and also removing that variation that you can see across Northern Ireland and particularly in rural areas. that was the basis for us consulting on a new clinical response model a couple of years ago, and I've spoken to the council about that previously. We introduced that in November 19 in relation to the new response target time, so that with the resources that we do have, we can target that more effectively at the patients who most need it, the sickest patients. But as part of that work, it was identified and agreed that in order to fully meet those standards right across Northern Ireland in all areas, we need in the order of an additional 320 operational staff. So we have been working with the Department of Health. We have developed a business case to seek to secure that funding, and we remain hopeful that we will start to see that funding be provided. Although, as Seamus outlined at the end of some of his questions, the financial outlook for next year is very concerning, and therefore that will make it challenging. But we are hopeful to start securing some funding to start move towards recruiting some of those additional staff. In the meantime, we're not standing still. We are continuing to recruit and train as many staff as we can with the funding we have. I was pleased this morning to welcome the latest group of 50 new student paramedics who are starting the foundation degree. They will finish that by the end of this calendar year and be operational as paramedics. At the same time, we have a number of emergency medical technician and ambulance care assistant programs underway, and we look forward to this September when Ulster University commences the very first BSc in paramedicine in Northern Ireland, a three-year program. We won't see anybody coming out of that until June 24, but it does provide us with a good supply of paramedics into the future. And while we can continue to strive to improve performance as much as we can and deliver efficiencies with the way we work, only by securing the funding for those additional staff will we really be able to improve the performance on a consistent basis that you want to see for your area. So that's an update of where we are and some of the challenges we have, and hopefully give you the context for some of our current performance that hopefully will help inform your questions. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Michael. That's a very thorough overview. Thanks for that. Okay, we have a couple of questions then. I think the first one, actually, Councillor Enright, you'd put a question in actually at the end of the South Eastern Trust's presentation of an ambulance services. Do you want to come in at this point before I take in Councillor McKee? Are you there, Cadogan? Okay, we'll pass on then. Councillor McKee, you're in next there. Work away. Harold, you must be on mute there.
Sorry about that.
No bother. No problem.
Thanks, Chair. Michael, thanks for that detailed report you put on there. Very, very good. Very interesting. Just a couple of wee things just reminded me that now is maybe no better time to ask the question, because on the 25th of August, I was one of those who was waiting for an ambulance. And anybody who waits for an ambulance, not that I really knew, but others around me knew, that it is an emergency. But it appeared to be that one of the, and I've heard it twice since it, from someone who looked for an ambulance a month before and one of it a month later, that the COVID situation seemed to be the priority. Whereas if you were someone who had, in my case, it was a stroke initially, it was a stroke, a heart, whatever it was, that you were put on some sort of a list, that the people around you somehow had to size up, has this patient ever had COVID? So they don't know. I'm not in a fit state to tell them. They guessed I didn't have COVID. I was out doing my day at work. But due to all of that, whoever was manning the telephone that day, after the second person got a hold of them, that they literally set the phone down because they wanted an answer for COVID. It didn't matter about my condition. Apparently I was bad that day, but it didn't matter. But somewhere or other, there has to be some sort of a compromise made there. And it has to be no doubt about it. It's a difficult one. But, I mean, I couldn't have asked that question had I not been in that situation. And just another wee point was, maybe that was from the back of the ambulance that I did receive. I did, maybe a month later, say to somebody, those ambulances are very noisy, rattly old things. Haven't been in one, first time ever, thank goodness. And he laughed. He says, pity you didn't see what you were in, he says, because you were not in one of those lovely yellow, blue flashlight ambulances. There was some other sort of a more, appeared to be like more of a private affair. I didn't ask a lot into it. But I then was told from other sources that some of those private ambulances may not have had the professional operators. I'll use the word operator. I don't know why they meant drivers or people, others at work, were not as professional as the ones that come from our National Health Service, if you like. So maybe, Michael, you could answer me then. A couple of points, please. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Councillor McKay. Well, I'll ask Rosie Byrne, who's Director of Operations, to comment on some of that in a moment. But firstly, good to see that you appear to be fitting well after your experience last August. So good to see that, Councillor McKay. The issue in relation to whenever you or somebody on your behalf phoned, whether someone has COVID or not, or suspected for COVID or not, doesn't make any difference at all to the priority in which they're sent an ambulance. Our call handlers will ask questions. Now, the very first questions they will ask is the patient conscious and breathing? And they do not wait to ask, are they showing any signs of COVID? So for the most clinically urgent, an ambulance is on its way, if we have one available, it's on its way within seconds. They will go on to ask some of those questions around whether the patient is known or showing signs of COVID, simply to make sure that our staff who are attending are wearing the appropriate PPE, etc. But it doesn't lead to any delay in an ambulance, and it certainly isn't a prioritisation that COVID are getting ahead of non-COVID. I can confirm that. In relation to a Ratley ambulance, I was actually going to say, well, it probably could have been one of ours. At the end of the day, these are vans that have been kitted out with very high-tech equipment, but they are vans. They will rattle. But we do use independent ambulance sector providers to supplement our capacity. It's one of the things that we've relied on heavily. We do expect them to attain to deliver certain standards, both of their vehicle and their staff. Their staff wouldn't have the same skills as ours, so therefore they don't attend the highest level of acuity calls. But I'll ask Rosie Byrne, as Director of Ops, if there's anything specific you want to add to that.
Yeah, I just concur with your comments about the higher acuity calls, that we would not allocate our independent provider support to those higher acuity calls. And Michael is absolutely right that when a call comes into our emergency control room, like many of the ambulance services, both in the UK and internationally, we use a clinical triage system that takes into account the variety of risk factors and the presentation of any illness or pain or injury. And patients, whether they call, whether they are COVID positive or we don't know if they're COVID positive, it doesn't have any bearing on the prioritisation. It's based on the clinical information at the time through a set of very specific bespoke questions. So not necessarily COVID related.
Thank you, Rosie. Thank you,
Michael. Laura, could I just quickly come in there and just say, there has to be a question around what that first point that I made, because I know both of you are saying that, but I just wish the other two guys were speaking to you now, and I think there has to be more of a formal complaint made from them. They wanted to at the time, and I said, hold on, but don't panic about that. But
Harold, can I maybe ask you to take that up maybe with Michael,
yeah,
even separately,
yeah,
off the call, just conscious of time, need a couple of other members looking at it. That's okay, Harold. Thank you.
All right, Laura. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Councillor Mulgrew, you're in next there.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to ask Michael, I mean, obviously it's great that we have, you know, the degree course starting for the paramedics and, you know, all of the other training courses coming on. And it's something we've talked about for a number of years now, trying to bridge that gap in lack of staffing. What I would like to know, Michael, for the likes of the degree course, where, as you say, you're not going to actually have feet in the ground until 2024, are there going to be enough people to replace the paramedics and ambulance personnel that will be due to retire in the interim? Or are we going to get an initial, further hit from the staffing issue? Are you happy that what is in place at the minute will be able to bridge as people retire and leave the service?
Thanks, Councillor Mulgrew. Yeah, we factor that into our workforce planning. Now, it is subject to funding, so I have to say that, but we have a plan in place that those 50 student paramedics that I greeted this morning, they will graduate very early in 2022. We have plans to commence another cohort of those students later in the year. And we've also got plans those staff are already our emergency medical technicians. So they're staff with lots of experience, but they need to be trained to a higher level of skills to do the full range of duties of a paramedic. So we've started one today. We've planned for one more to start later in the year, but we can also recruit people straight off the street with no training and put them through a 2-year foundation degree program. So we have plans to do one of those as well. So if we can attract the funding or secure the funding from the department to run a further cohort of student paramedics for our own staff and a 2-year program for completely new starts, that will continue to give us a supply of paramedics coming out in 2022 and again in 2023. And then we will wait and get the first students coming out of UU in 2024. So there is a plan that will do it. All it will achieve, as you rightly point out, are replacing people who retire or leave. It won't materially increase our numbers. For that, we need the funding from the department, and that we would ramp up our numbers based on that. But we do have a plan that will make sure that we at least keep up to date with our current staffing level.
I suppose, Michael, just to reach your council degree, I would also say that as part of our workforce planning and our strategy, we absolutely look at the age profile of our staff, the different sort of levels and qualifications that they all have. We look at our attrition rate. So absolutely factoring that into workforce planning moving forward.
Thank you, Rosie. Thank you, Michael. Okay, Councillor Traynor.
Yeah, very briefly, Chair. It's just in relation to intermediate care vehicles. And I know that Michael will remember that I've probably raised this every year now since we first talked about it. Part of his strategy in relation to bridging the gap, I suppose, with regards to operation of NIAS was possibly looking at the enhancement and the expansion of intermediate care vehicles past the times that they're normally running at. I don't see that in the presentation today, and I haven't seen that referenced since probably 2019. I just really wanted to follow up with Michael. Is that still a priority going forward, or is there still that idea of trying to expand the intermediate care vehicles to support the first response ambulances?
Yeah, and we've relied heavily on it over the last 6-8 months, Councillor Traynor. It wasn't on the slides, as you said, but I think it did make brief reference to we supplement our A&E crews, our paramedics and our EMTs, by the staff who work on the non-emergency side, who then work in IC vehicles. But Rosie would have more detail on some. We're doing some of that on a normal business, that there are some of our staff who just moved into doing that ICV most of the time, and then we increased that considerably over the last few months, as indeed we brought in staff from PSNI and the fire service to work alongside them. But Rosie could just give a bit more of the detail on our plans in that regard.
What we did, we took the opportunity of COVID, if you like, whenever hospital provider trusts were downturning some of their routine, let's say, outpatient work that our PCS staff would have been focusing on, move those over, a number of them to do A&E support, and at staggered shift times, not just the normal 9-to-5 or 8-to-4 shifts that they would have been used to working. So they have, they've been working into the evening, and we have found that really helpful, and that still continues.
Okay, that's great. And we've no other questions at the minute, Mike or Rosie, from members. I suppose just on behalf of the council, thank you so much for taking the time this afternoon and for all that you do right across the north. That's very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you. If we're content then, folks, to move on to the last part of the agenda, which is with the Southern Trust. I think we have Shane Devlin on the call this afternoon. I do have to apologise, Shane. I think the running order as well. Last time you came last at the end of the meeting, we saved the best for last. I am really sorry. We should have swapped it around this time and allowed you to go first.
Serve the best wine last. Why not?
So I do apologise. I'm not sure, Shane, if you were here at the start of the call. The plan will be for a half an hour. Hopefully we'll be get finished before then. So maybe a wee brief overview from you in terms of where the Trust is at present, and then hopefully open the floor to some questions.
I certainly can do. I'm not going to do a presentation because probably at this point in time you've probably had too many presentations. But what I will do is just give an overview. And then specifically you had asked some questions pre the meeting. And I just want to pull on some of those to give you some thoughts back on the questions that you had sent through, if that's okay. So in terms of where we are, as you know, we're at a place now in COVID, with regards to COVID, where we're absolutely coming down the other side of the hill. What I would say is the Southern Trust had the single biggest number of COVID inpatients of any of the five trust areas. And in particular, we know the Euro Council area, ABC and Mid-Ulster, for quite a while since the beginning of December, had the highest levels of COVID positive in our community. And we saw a massive divergence on the 4th of January, whereby all the council areas were roughly tracking at the same level. And the 4th of January saw a massive divergence, and the Southern Trust numbers went up by 30% compared to the other populations of Northern Ireland, which turned into an enormous number of inpatients. At one point, we had over 300 concurrent inpatients in the Southern Trust. And it meant that actually we had an extraordinarily difficult Christmas and the New Year. What I would say is, as of yesterday, the community levels in the Southern Trust are in and around the average in Northern Ireland. And in terms of the number of COVID patient positive patients we have in our Trust area, we're at the lowest level we've had since the end of September. So we find ourselves in a position whereby, from a COVID perspective, we are now in a much, much better position. As you will have heard from Seamus, what we're now all doing is developing our rebuild plans, which are coming to our Trust Board actually on Thursday. If any of you are interested in attending our Trust Board, I know that, Harold, you have attended a few of them recently, so thank you. And that plan will come to our Trust Board on Thursday, which will absolutely look at what are we going to do for the next 3 months in terms of rebuild. As you can appreciate, or I hope you can appreciate, a lot of our staff are absolutely asking for time to rest, to reflect and actually refresh. So we do not envisage we will be running at 100% quickly. We do need people to take time to take leave. We need people to take time to take the hours they're owed and actually get back into some kind of normality, because the journey for many has been a horrendous and horrific journey. What I would say is that our plan will be made public at our Trust Board on Thursday, albeit in draft form. It's for the Minister to approve or not approve whether the plan is acceptable. What I would then just, if I can, if that's okay, just I'll use the questions that you posed to me in the pre-letter to give an understanding of where we are, and then I'm happy to take questions. So in terms of the first area that you'd raised in the pre-letter was about access to GPs. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't run GP services. Okay, the GPs are independent contractors that are managed through the Health and Social Care Board. So the query with regards to people getting access, I have no control over, because it's not part of the Trust. And therefore, what I would suggest is that the Health and Social Care Board is probably the best place to have that discussion in terms of getting better access to GPs. The question was, second area was very much about waiting times for appointments and treatments, and have they lengthened during the COVID period? They absolutely have. So we find ourselves with approximately 14,000 more people waiting for procedures, so whether that's inpatient procedure or whether that's a day case procedure, and our outpatient lists have increased by approximately 10%. So in response to the questions, absolutely, we've seen a growth in both inpatient and outpatient waits. What I would stress is that our rebuild plan is looking to very quickly address some of those. And the other thing is that we are looking at the most seriously ill patients being looked after on a regional basis. So if people are waiting for severe cancer surgery, for example, it may be the case that some of the patients from our geography will be seen in the Belfast Trust or seen in other places, because we're now looking at the capacity on a shared basis rather than just on a postcode basis. So that's a very important point. And there's a regional oversight group every week that looks at all the people who are waiting across the whole of Northern Ireland and says, actually, how can we get these people seen as quickly as possible? And that's taken on a regional basis. So in answer to the question, yes, there are more waits. We have plans in place. However, what I would stress is that we still do not have all the capacity we need, and therefore there will absolutely still be waits. The third area was in terms of the vaccination program. And we obviously have our large vaccination centre in South Lake in Craigavon. And the question is very much, would there not be an opportunity to have one in a different place? What I would say is that the vaccination strategy is one which is a regional strategy. It's one the Department of Health takes the lead on. We haven't plans to set up a mass vaccination centre. But what there are plans for is that local pharmacy will take over a lot of the vaccination when the AstraZeneca vaccine becomes more flowing. So we would envisage that people would get access to the vaccine through potentially community pharmacies. And my understanding is across the whole of Northern Ireland, I think 360 community pharmacies have said they would be very interested in delivering that kind of service. So I think between the GP, between community pharmacy, and then also the mass vaccination centres, of which there are seven, and the new one opening up in Belfast in the SSC arena, there would be an opportunity. I would like to think that people would get access. I appreciate for some people that might mean driving and quite a distance. But in terms of the vaccination centre, we are not resourced at the moment to be able to deliver that anywhere else at the moment. And also the vaccine needs to be stored in a particular way, which I can get into in detail if people want to know about that. The fourth question was about the scare stories about vaccine, and I hope some of those have been put to bed. The AstraZeneca vaccine is safe. Again, the World Health Organization and actually the European Health Protection Agency have both confirmed that very recently. So the AstraZeneca vaccine is absolutely safe. With any vaccine, there are some people who have had side effects. And with any vaccine, we've also got to be very well aware that it is an effective vaccine. It is not a perfect vaccine. So it's not 100%, never will be 100%. But in terms of the scare stories, I think it's really important to note that if you look at the evidence, we all look at the evidence, vaccines are safe and do what they're meant to do. And I couldn't encourage people more strongly to get the vaccine. It is our route out of this pandemic. And I really, really, really must stress that that's an important thing that people, when offered, and many have been offered already, we've now nearly half of the population of Northern Ireland, but when offered, people really should take the vaccine. The question about Middlebank Newry and the testing centre, unfortunately, again, that isn't one that we run. That's run by the Public Health Agency and a private, a private company as well. So I have no influence over that testing centre. But what I would say, if there are challenges in the Public Health Agency, are the people who run the testing centre. If necessary, through yourself, Laura, I can send details of the Public Health Agency and who you would contact on that one. But it just isn't something, it's not our business, we don't run it. And therefore, if there were issues, I'm more than happy to direct people in the right way. But at the moment, I don't run it. And then the final aspect you raised was about how Daisy Hill is coping. There is no doubt Daisy Hill was stretched to the limit with regards to the COVID issues. We had all hospitals are limited by a number of factors in terms of staff, in terms of facilities, and a major limiting factor was oxygen. So it wasn't so much oxygen storage, but it was oxygen flow. The pipes in the building, are the pipes. The building itself wasn't built yesterday. And as a result, there were huge demands on oxygen, which resulted in us having to double the capacity, double the flow, and staff and oxygen and beds were stretched to an absolute limit. What I would say is that we are now returning to some form of normal. And quite clearly, the hospital has got up to speed. ED is running at a real phenomenal pace. Our theatres are back up and running. And there is no doubt that it is getting back to normality, although it won't feel that way. So we still have the donning and doffing station, which is where people put their PPE on. We still have limited visiting, only for end of life and certain maternity, because actually we are still hugely concerned about the opportunity for infection, spread of infection. COVID hasn't gone away. The hospital is full of vulnerable people, and we really, really could not afford to have the kind of outbreak we had in Mayo Medical in Daisy Hill, which unfortunately cost a number of lives. So until we are content with the risk that we're carrying, and that risk is about community levels, it's about PPE and all kinds of things, it won't feel like the way the hospital used to feel, but that's just unfortunately where we are with regards to COVID at the moment. So that gives you a flavour of where we are. More than happy to take questions on any element of that. It does feel like we're starting to get back to a little bit more like a normal society and environment, but it certainly isn't actually normal yet. But I'm more than happy to take questions or comments.
Okay, Shane, as usual. Thanks very much for that. Okay, we've got a couple of questions there. The first one's from Councillor Casey. Go on ahead there, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Laura. It's about GP services. Shane, I don't know if you can address any of that now. If you can't, I can leave it to maybe we might have someone representing.
Yeah, unfortunately, Councillor, we don't run GP services. Now, what I would absolutely be happy to do, and I can do it through the chair, is that I can give you the appropriate details. So it will be people in the Health and Social Care Board who look after what's called general medical services. So I will more than happy send that through to you, to the chair, and that can be distributed to the councillors.
Thanks, Shane. Thanks, Laura.
Yep, no bother at all. That'll be great, Shane. Thank you. Okay, Councillor McAteer, you're on next there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Shane, for the update. I see there's a bit of feedback, I think, in my voice anyway. I don't know if it's coming through to everybody or not, but anyway. Shane, just possibly to get answered them. I know I had spoke to one doctor recently in a meeting I was in, and they spoke about the red flag referrals made by GPs. Now, but this particular gentleman said he had no response to red flag ones for quite some months later. Bit worrying, you know, there. So that was one. The other thing, again, and just to touch on the waiting lists, 365,000 people on waiting lists, 160,000 are first-time appointments in Northern Ireland. So again, you know, that is having a big impact on everything, actually, you know. So that's two questions. Third question, or part of the third question is, could you ask why are diabetes specialists, nurses, and antenatal clinics actually not seeing people face-to-face, while others, like doctors, McMillan nurses, practice nurses, actually are? Because that has been a complaint in the community as well, that there's no face-to-face meetings there. And again, people are suffering because of that. Now, I don't know if it's connected with COVID or not, but certainly it has had an impact. And my final question is, could you give us some update at all on the new community treatment centre for Newry? Because it was approved at our planning committee quite some time ago, and there still doesn't seem to be any movement on that.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you very much, Councillor McAteer. In terms of red flags and waiting, that's correct. I mean, a red flag is a suspected cancer that a GP will raise, and that red flag referral then comes into us, and we attempt to see those red flags, depending on which cancer site, in certain timelines. And we have, unfortunately, during COVID, have not been able to address all the red flags that came through. And in many cases, because the clinicians have been working in COVID areas. So if you take, if someone needs red flag breast surgery, many of the red flag surgeries didn't happen because the theatre nursing staff and the anaesthetists were working on intensive care. So that's what happened to a lot of Red Flag, because the staff had to work in other COVID areas. We have a plan to try and address some of those red flags, the same with the waiting list. And we will work through those and we'll get through them as quickly as possible. All of the staff who were in intensive care are now back in the theatres and back in the wards. So we start to have our staff again. But unfortunately, we still have a mismatch between the number of people who need an appointment and the resources that we have. So there will continue to be waits. I can't say anything other than that, unfortunately. There will continue to be waits. We do not have enough of nurses, doctors and others to actually address all of the people waiting. Now, I know I heard Seamus McGoran at the end talking about the budget settlement. It's very clear the draft proposed budget settlement does not give me the resources I need to meet all the demand. So I really wish it did, but it doesn't, and I just have to be honest with that. I don't have the resources to meet all the demand. And as you say, nearly 100, well, more than 150,000 people on first waiting list, 320-something on the list in total. I do not have the resources I need to address those demands. So I will work with the commissioner, I'll work with the department, I'll try and get as much resources as I can, but I'm just being honest. I don't have the resources I need to meet all of those demands. With regards to why face-to-face isn't happening yet, there will be individuals, as in face-to-face, so you talk about, I think it was diabetes and antenatal
specialists, yes, and antenatal. Yeah.
So I would have to look into individually, because each service does a risk assessment as to what can be seen, and therefore I will go back and see why diabetes and antenatal isn't or is, and I can come back to you with a definite answer. Mm-hmm. Most of the risk assessments have been about aerosol-generating services. So in other words, it was ENT, or if it was actually maternity, you know, it generates aerosol-generating particles, which in themselves can be dangerous. I struggle a little bit about diabetes and antenatal, because I can't see how the aerosol-generating would reflect on those.
Absolutely.
Well, go and find out, because I don't have an answer, but I will come back through Laura with the answer, if that's okay.
That's perfect.
And
the
update
on the community.
Yes, it's with our minister at the moment. So I chased up this morning. So the minister, because it was approved by the department under direction of our minister, the Minister for Health at the time, who was Edwin Poots, believe it or not, that's how long ago it was. And therefore it has to go back to the minister. So my understanding is it's in the minister's inbox. I tried to chase it up this morning to understand exactly where it is. So I'm awaiting an update from the minister to understand where it is to progress forward even further. So it has been approved. The model then goes through the Health and Social Care Board back up to the department for them to give the final sign off from the Department of Health, and it's in the minister's intro.
Yeah, because it would impact, you'd agree, it would impact greatly in the leg of our area to relieve some of the, you know, the blockages that are, aren't there, in services.
I think it's a game changer, as I've said, actually at the planning committee, I think I said that. I think it's a game changer, because it could really change the service model that we have. I mean, Daisy Hill's full to the brim, we know that. John Mitchell Place is full to the brim. You know, we need that kind of growth. So we're pushing very hard, but my understanding is it's with the minister to finally approve.
Okay. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shane. Thank you, Declan. I see there in the comments box that Owen Devlin has just reminded us all that following the last meeting, that the concerns regarding the GP referrals and practices was actually referred to the Health and Social Care Council at that point. That was back, I think, a few weeks ago. So hopefully we'll get a response on that too. But I think, yeah, but some contact from you as well would be good, Shane. Okay, and we've one more question in there from Councillor Murphy. Do you want to go on ahead, Declan?
Thanks, Laura. Shane, maybe you'll be able to answer this for me. This is with regards to the services that are available for under 18s in relation to alcohol and drug misuse. You know, what services are currently available, and are they going back to face-to-face services?
Okay. In terms of that which is available, that would tend to come through our Children's Services Directorate and our CAM services. So I would have to give you a specific answer to the details of them. Are they heading back to face-to-face? Yes, they are, is the answer to that, Declan. So we are heading back to, as far as is possible, heading back to face-to-face, definitely. But in terms of specifically, I'd have to speak to Paul, my Director of Children's Services, to just see exactly what specific services are available. I wouldn't have that, unfortunately, at the top of my head.
No, that's dead on. That's dead on. Thanks.
But I can get you an answer for that.
That's dead on, Shane.
Okay. Thank you, Shane. Okay. Have we any other members that would like to come in there and ask anything of Shane? No. No. I think that's everybody, Shane. Listen, thank you very much for your attendance this evening.
You're very welcome.
Very much appreciated. We hope to see you soon.
Yeah. All the best. And stay safe, everyone. And get your vaccine.
You too.
Get your vaccine.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, members, thanks for your cooperation this evening. We'll see you all soon. Take care.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair. Thank you, Laura.